Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to World Weekly with me, Sean Donnan, the FT's world news editor. On the show this week, fury in the European Union as Britain wields the veto and efforts to bring the Eurozone crisis to an end continue. We've got a global accord on climate change in Durban and many more years of negotiations to come. But first, to the repercussions for the European Union after Britain's refusal to back steps towards closer fiscal integration. Is this really the beginning of a two-speed Europe? Joining me on the line from Brussels is FT Bureau Chief Peter Spiegel, and with me in the studio here in London is Ben Hall, our Europe news editor and deputy world news editor. Ben, why don't we start with you? This veto of a new treaty for Europe really is effectively the UK exercising the nuclear option, something that's normally kept as a deterrent rather than something that's rolled out. What is this going to mean for the UK and Europe going forward?
I think all of that depends on how things pan out over the next few weeks and months in terms of this new treaty, ostensibly a treaty amongst the 26 other members of the EU. If it's wide-ranging and if it allows for certain things like much closer integration on tax, labour market policy, other areas that might be considered part of the single market, as well as all of the other stuff on fiscal rules and automatic sanctions, et cetera, for fiscal sinners, then I think it's very bad news for the UK. But if it's a much more minimalist treaty, then I think possibly the UK might be able to get away without fundamental damage to its vital national interests. I think what is clear, though, is that this was a watershed moment because whether by accident or design, the UK has absented itself from those discussions about how important the scope of this treaty is. They have no voice. And I think that is the first time in a generation, if not even longer, that the UK has wanted to do that. And I think it's a very worrying shift.
So how is this fiscal compact, as it's been called, developing, Peter?
The interesting thing which makes this whole split even more peculiar. I mean, much of what's in this fiscal compact has already been agreed by most of the participants. It is things like preventing your debt-to-GDP ratio going above 60% and preventing your annual budget deficit from going above 3% of GDP. I mean, these are all things that have already been in the pipeline and in many cases already passed through normal EU legislative procedures. What the reason there was an insistence on doing this treaty change measure was that Germany in particular wanted this to be unchangeable. They wanted to be in the what they call the primary law of the EU, the founding treaties. We have to put that in there to make sure this never happens again. So to be honest with you, on the substance, there's largely agreement already. There's largely, including among the UK, that they're going to go down this path. And this is only going to govern the Eurozone for the time being. And there are already penalties in place that if you disagree or you violate these rules and you violate the recommendations from the bureaucrats here in Brussels, you'll get fined and whatnot. So much of what is being touted as a new fiscal compact has already been agreed. And that's what makes this whole debate somewhat irrelevant, to be honest with you, to the current crisis.
But the big question, of course, is does this fiscal compact, does the fact that they've agreed on closer fiscal integration as part of a sort of choreographed response, we are expecting the French, we're talking about a Christmas present from the European Central Bank to follow this, some kind of broader, bigger intervention from the ECB. I mean, are we seeing the signs that Europe is finally moving to resolve this crisis?
Well, that's the problem. And I know there are senior officials here in Brussels and elsewhere who are very concerned that all this talk of treaty change and all this talk of a fiscal compact will, in the words of one person I talked to, you know, it's all well and good for the next crisis, to prevent the next crisis, but does very little to deal with the current crisis. On that regard, what people with the markets are looking for is some sign that the Europeans are coming up with what's being universally called the big bazooka. And whether that bazooka is through national governments putting up new money for a firewall or for bailouts or for rescues, or the ECB intervening on a much greater scale and a much more aggressive scale. We haven't seen that yet, and that's why I think the markets have responded very badly. I mean, even the last two summits, the last two summits to end all summits to save the euro, at least we had a few days of positive response from the markets. We almost had no positive response from the markets in this one, because I think people see some of this treaty change debate as a sideshow. They don't see the ECB intervening. The messages coming out of the ECB and Mario Draghi, the new president of the ECB, were quite mixed. We don't see new resources being devoted to the bailout mechanisms. We saw no commitment to commonly issued bonds, which is also seen as a way of guaranteeing the debts of the Southerners who are in trouble. We didn't see any movement on any of those things. So I think that's the concern, that we might have yet another summit to save the euro in a couple months.
So, Ben, is there really another summit to save the euro left? I mean, really, in terms of the markets, in terms of their patience for a European response?
I'm not sure whether the markets are prepared to wait another 3 months, but I think European leaders certainly seem to think that they can come back in March and have another go at boosting the size of the Eurozone's rescue funds and maybe nailing down the final bits of bigger resources for the IMF. And then possibly the question of the big ECB role in backstopping the bond markets. But whether the bond markets are prepared to wait for that, I think is a big question. And whether or not actually the financial system is robust enough across the Eurozone to cope with essentially not much action from Eurozone leaders remains to be seen, frankly. And we shouldn't forget, of course, this is all taking a massive toll on the real economy, you know, pushing the Eurozone deeper into recession. It's going to be pretty grim for the first bit of next year, that's for sure.
So let's talk about next year a little bit more. Peter, walk me through how you think this is going to unfold over the next year.
Well, I mean, to date, and then this crisis has gone on, gosh, almost over 18 months already, and the dynamic has always been people with here in Brussels and, frankly, now internationally, pushing the Germans to basically at some point acknowledge that they are going to have to use their balance sheet as the largest and healthiest economy in Europe to shore up the rest of the Eurozone. And gradually, over the course of the last year and a half, they have allowed that to some extent. They have allowed some growth in the use of the bailout fund, which, let's be honest, is primarily backed by the Germans. They have allowed some use of the ECB to buy Italian and Spanish bonds. Again, that is basically German largely money going to buy those bonds. And we've started to see a change in rhetoric in Germany on the issue of Eurobonds, which is these commonly issued bonds. They've gone from absolutely to no to no, but maybe in the future. And so I think at the course of the next year, as this crisis becomes even more acute, all the focus is going to be on Berlin and to the extent to which Angela Merkel feels comfortable enough with her own domestic political situation that she's able to give ground on those things. I mean, this is the quid pro quo that everyone has been anticipating. If Merkel gets her fiscal compact, if she gets these rules embedded in the treaties, she can then go to her domestic audience and say, okay, right, we've gotten our quid, now we need our quo, which is, you know, we must show what is called here in Europe solidarity. We must show that we're willing to help out our southern brethren and allow more, frankly, German money to be lent and used in rescuing the rest of the Eurozone. And so I think that's the dynamic we're going to see out over the course of the next year. Now, what Ben pointed out is whether the bond markets are willing to wait that long. Let's remember, early next year we have a huge amount, tens of billions of euros of Italian and Spanish debt that needs to be issued. And right now, both Italian and Spanish debt is trading at anywhere between 6 and 7%, which most people in the markets believe is unsustainable. It does add a huge amount of money to the debt levels of both countries. So can we go forward and wait for Germany to come forward finally with its solidarity plan? Can we wait months for that? And can the bond market wait months for that? And if not, then what? Does it mean some sort of rescue plan from the IMF? It can't be a full-fledged bailout because, as everyone points out, you know, Italy is too big to bail. It's just with 1.9 trillion in euros in debt, there is no program big enough to save Italy. But do we do a line of credit? Do we do some sort of bridging loan that allows Italy to borrow at a much lower rate over the course of the next year and then quickly move back into the markets when things settle down? And that's what we need to watch. Over the next 3 months, how does that dynamic play out?
And also, what does Mario Draghi do, president of the European Central Bank? I mean, how he reacts to the next few months, I think, is absolutely crucial, as important as Merkel's role, frankly. And he's in a rather tricky position because he argues that it's national government's responsibility to sort out this problem. One would conclude from the summit on Thursday and Friday that they haven't sorted it out. And yet he is potentially the saviour of the euro. Will he intervene heavily enough to prop up the bond markets and prevent the European Eurozone economy from crashing? That's the real question, I think, for the next few, for the early part of next year. And it's not a not an easy one for Draghi to deal with.
I mean, we've already talked about the impact on the real economy in the Eurozone, but what we haven't talked about so much is the impact on the global economy, really. I mean, there are people talking about 2012 as a much grimmer year than 2011. The real possibility that we could get a double-dip recession globally. At some point, people have been talking about the IMF, BRIC countries, other parts of the world getting involved and helping out the Eurozone. When are we going to see the IMF get involved? How are they going to get involved? And when are we going to see that Chinese money descend on Europe?
I think there's still a strong feeling in the BRIC countries and elsewhere, voiced by Japan, for example, that the Europeans still haven't put their own house in order. And I think that's quite worrying too, because it means we won't get that big boost to IMF resources with all sorts of other countries coming in. So I fear we've got quite a long way to go before we get the bigger IMF package on board.
Prediction time. This is a sovereign debt crisis. It's also an existential crisis for the euro. At the end of 2012, will we still have the euro, Ben?
Yes.
Peter?
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, I think all this sort of rhetoric about the end of the euro fails to take into account how costly it would be, not only for the European economy, but for the global economy to break up the euro. And I think all you have to do is look at the discussion over whether Greece should be kicked out of the euro, which really sort of gained a lot of rhetorical credence when George Papandreou, the prime minister, discussed a referendum on the bailout program. When people sat down in the cold light of day and said, what really is involved with kicking Greece out of the euro, the costs were enormous. It's not only shutting down the entire Greek banking system and probably closing the borders of Greece so that people didn't run out with suitcases full of euros. It meant the entire meltdown of the Greek banking system, which would have huge knock-on effects on every other European bank. If I have a euro, let's pick a country because I'm here in Belgium, and say it's a Belgian euro, and I have it sitting in a Belgian bank account, and I say, well, hey, look what they just did to my euros in Greece. They turned them into drachmas. What are they going to do to my Belgian euro? All of a sudden, every single bank in every single non-German European country sees a run on their banks. People move their euros out of those banks and into Germany. And the complete collapse of the European financial system is what follows. So I think when people start really looking at what the consequences are for kicking someone out or breaking up the euro, I think the costs are just too high. And the other thing is, we have to remember the political cost of this. Does Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy want to go down as the two leaders who destroyed the euro? And I think that is really how they would go down in history if it broke up. And there's just too much political consequence for that to happen. So I think for political reasons, financial reasons, and economic reasons, I don't think that's really in the cards, despite the rhetoric you hear out of some corners. I think they will finally find a way to either get the ECB or the German sovereign to back up the rest of the eurozone and ride this storm out so that the economy, real economy, starts picking up again, and they can deal with this in a much less crisis-oriented atmosphere.
I think one of the key questions, though, will be the extent to which these new treaty obligations actually push any of the current eurozone members out of the euro. I mean, Ireland is the obvious one. If they have to have a referendum on new fiscal rules, if they, in the current circumstances, I think many people in Ireland would say it would be very difficult to get a yes vote. What happens to Ireland and what happens to that treaty? That's a really tricky question.
And it's one of the many questions we're going to be coming back to in the months to come as we keep tracking this crisis. Peter Spiegel in Brussels, thank you very much. Ben Hall here in the studio, thank you. Let's move from the crisis in the Eurozone to climate change. We had 2 weeks of almost equally torturous negotiations in Durban. Delegates from almost 200 nations brought the talks back from the brink of collapse, thrashing out a compromise. Clive Cookson, the FT's science editor, has spoken to our environment correspondent, Polita Clark, who was at the Durban talks. Clive began by asking Polita how much more, if anything, had been achieved at the Durban meeting.
When one asks how much the world has got out of it, I'm afraid that they have basically agreed to agree to talk. That's what's happened here. They have agreed that by 2015 they will not only have managed to agree on the second phase of Kyoto, but they will have done this rather historic, really, treaty which is going to bring in all countries, not just the relatively small number that have always been in Kyoto. And they're going to bring them all in, and they will, by 2015, negotiate a global agreement with legal force, whatever that may or may not mean, that will see all countries curbing their emissions.
And is there any legal obligation to keep talking? I mean, as you say, there are lots of semantics all around the world, the word legal, but does this guarantee that something will be agreed by 2015 and come into force in 2020?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not an international lawyer, but my feeling is that there is now a strong impetus for that to be done. But as we've seen just last night, when it comes to legally binding, even something like the Kyoto Protocol, which is the world's only legally binding global treaty, is by no means fail-safe, because we saw Canada just announcing that it was going to pull out of it.
Yes, Kyoto had a get-out clause.
Yeah, well, I mean, the penalties under Kyoto basically say that if you fail to meet your commitments in the first phase, then you have to make up for it in the second phase. Now, we've only just this weekend agreed that there will, in fact, be a second phase. So you can see that, you know, that Kyoto agreement was actually agreed in 1997. It took until 2005, really, for it to come into force. And now, here we are in 2011, they finally agree a second commitment period, just a year before the first was due to run out. And we're already seeing one of the large countries that had signed up to it saying, well, sorry, not only are we not going in for a second commitment period, which they'd already announced, sorry, this is terribly complicated, but we're also pulling out of the treaty altogether, so we don't want to be punished. So there we go. This is what the world of climate negotiations must deal with.
How damaging is Canada's withdrawal?
Well, I mean, I think what it shows is that despite the euphoria, which there really was in the early hours of Sunday morning, not least since it finally finished, but there was enormous relief that this global treaty, this second pact, had been agreed upon. But I think what Canada has done is really puncture that rather sharply, and it has shown the difficulties with actually getting countries to abide by these sorts of agreements. Before anyone starts talking about this second pact, we've seen how easy it is to withdraw from them.
Well, presumably that's a lesson that can be learnt for whatever it follows Kyoto. It'll have to be impossible to wriggle out like that.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was this extraordinary argy-bargy right on the conference floor at around 2:30 a.m. in the morning, where literally the negotiators and their lawyers were arguing about the difference between the terms protocol, legal instrument, agreed outcome with legal force, which is what we've got in the end. But it's a choice between all of them. And now I'm afraid what we're going to see is several years leading up to 2015, where there is a huge amount of debate and discussion about what this actually constitutes on the ground.
Let's talk about one of the positives. You wrote a story in the immediate aftermath for Monday's paper where you quoted a banker saying this was like Viagra for the carbon trading markets that were flagging, shall we say.
Well, I think if you were involved in the global carbon markets, as Mr. Kamali, the Bank of America banker that I quoted, is, then you're incredibly relieved that there was not a train wreck in Durban, because had there been, it would have taken even more air out of the markets than we've already seen. We've seen prices, largely as a result of the Eurozone crisis, because the world's largest carbon market is, in fact, the European Emissions Trading Scheme. Largely as a result of that, we've seen carbon prices go down to record lows. But there's also an oversupply problem in the market. Had there been, on top of that, a failure in Durban, where the world was looking as if it was not at all interested in increasing any sort of environmental ambition, then that would have been another nail in what's looking like a not quite sealed coffin, but one that's sort of heading towards the graveyard. So, yes, they're very relieved more than anything else. As for whether it's actually going to put up carbon prices dramatically in the next sort of weeks and months, then that's another issue, I fear.
And lastly, could you run through how the negotiating process to 2015 and 2020 might go. I don't mean all the steps, but just what might happen.
Very, very broadly, what will be done first is that the countries will tackle the second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. As you know, the first runs out by the end of 2012. So what they will do in the coming months is they will figure out how to precisely which countries are going to be in it and what sort of targets and what sort of length. We don't even know how long this one's going to be. The first was 5 years, the second maybe eight. They will then start looking at this much more difficult process of the global treaty involving all parties. And we will start seeing a discussion of this in these, what they call intersessionals, another lovely UN word, these meetings leading up to the next COP, the next conference of the parties, the next annual meeting, which is going to be in Qatar at the end of next year.
That was Clive Cookson and Polita Clark. And that's it for this week. My thanks to Peter Spiegel in Brussels and Ben Hall, Clive Cookson and Polita Clark in the studio. Till next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.